prosecution is not going to get that man today. No. Because I'm going to get him. My client, the Honorable Henry T. Fleming, should go right to fucking jail. The son of a bitch is guilty. That man is guilty. That man there, that man is a slime. He is a slime. If he's allowed to go free, then something really wrong is going on.
Mr. Kirkland, you are out of order.
You're out of order. You're out of order. The whole trial is out of order. They're out of order. That man, that crazy, depraved man, raped and beat that woman there, and he'd like to do it again. He told me so. It's just a show. It's a show. Let's make a deal. Let's make a deal. Hey, Frank, you want to make a deal? I got an insane judge who likes to beat the shit out of women. What do you want to give me, Frank? 3 weeks probation?
Damn it.
You son of a bitch, you. You're supposed to stand for something. You're supposed to protect people, but instead you fucking murder them. You killed McCullough. You killed him. Hold it. Hold it. I just completed my opening statement.
Hello and welcome to Stuff We've Seen. This is Jim. Now, here he is, the legal representation for Tulsi Gabbard in her defamation lawsuit against Hillary Clinton, Teal.
$50 million.
Oh, is that how much? I just laughed when I heard it because...
No, she's suing for $50 million because that seems appropriate.
You know... Nobody has to derail her campaign to be president. She just derailed it herself.
Yeah.
Would you ever vote for somebody who's so petty and who's so thin-skinned that they would sue somebody from supposedly her own party for defamation?
For making a, you know, annoying comment.
Yeah. I mean, that doesn't show leadership in my book. Not to be the president of the United States. And I know she's got bad examples right now in the White
House. Before we go down this rabbit hole.
Yeah. Well, you're the one defending her.
I wasn't defending her.
You're the representation.
Oh, yes. You're right. I am.
See, you don't even want the job. I don't even want that job.
I quit. I don't want the job.
Right. So you have a new job next week for next episode.
Next episode, I'll have a new job.
Yeah. You can join the impeachment defense team. Defend the undefendable.
Before we get started here, I want to mention that you've had a little bit of a cold.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, and so have I. And so we might sound a little scratchy and coughy and sniffly today.
Rawr, tiger.
Yes.
But we're very spriteful today. We're full of, I hear that. I hear that cough there. Yep. That little cold.
I've got that little cold in there.
Okay. So look, it's been about a little over a week since we got the Oscar nominations. And then, believe it or not, just in a few weeks, there will be the awards themselves.
Yes.
Not a very long season. But boy, the social media, and I actually monitored it for the first time in a long time. I've actually been very active.
Okay.
Yeah, with the account. If people want to follow along on Twitter, stuff_VE at Twitter, we've been posting some things. You just don't realize we've been posting things.
But you've been monitoring the award reactions on social media?
Oh, yes. Yes. So for like the first 48 hours after the awards, people were just all up in arms that, you know, the anointed one there, Greta Gerwig, didn't get nominated for Little Women.
Right.
And then the outrage was also that Jennifer Lopez didn't get a nomination for that horrible movie, Hustlers.
Yeah, well, she's the best part of it.
But that's so the best part of a terrible movie.
Well, but I would not have been upset if she did get a nomination.
Well, I wouldn't have been upset because I kind of felt like, oh, for some reason they've decided that, you know, through all the awards that she's worthy. And so
right. It
wouldn't have shocked me. And, you know, I mean, I was upset, of course, that Adam Sandler didn't get a nomination for Uncut Gems and the movie completely was ignored. However, I got over it in 10 minutes.
Yeah. Funny how that is, right?
Well, because I know that just because I liked the movie a lot and was very passionate about it, that doesn't mean it's going to always make the cut.
Well, also, I got to say that, you know, putting too much emotional energy into what the Academy does is probably not the best idea. I think, you know, that's part of my reaction to these is like, I kind of go, yeah, that's the Academy. That's how the Academy rolls. Like, what am I going to do? Get upset with them for that? Not really.
Yeah, and I can't complain in a year when some of my favorite films, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, The Irishman, Parasite, Joker, I mean, these are good movies, and they got nominated. Well, of course, then, you know, there was a ton of hate piled on Joker as if, how dare Joker even be nominated for 11 awards? And
how dare you?
Picking on things, and maybe rightfully so, that it got nominated for Best Makeup and Hairstyle, and, you know, but so people, you know, they had the knives out for various movies, and then they also had a lot of anger that Lupita Nyong'o wasn't nominated for a horror movie, Us.
It was a good performance.
Yeah, it was a good performance in a horror movie. Everybody's got to just calm down.
And
about,
not a very good horror movie either.
Well, you and I talked about it. And,
yeah, we did.
And we saw it, right? And I enjoyed myself as I enjoy a good horror movie.
Oh, I did too. But I like the movie less as time goes on.
Well, the problem is that everybody wants to like put Jordan Peele up on some amazing pedestal. And it's like, listen, the guy, he's making horror movies, which is probably a genre he enjoys.
Yeah.
And he's bringing a little bit of something new to the table each time. As far as like what that they can be a little bit more than just, you know, your scary horror, or he's using like what's happening in today's society to make a little point and also do some horror, and that makes it an elevated horror movie, but not to the point of Oscars.
Right, exactly. I mean, it is definitely better than your average horror flick. Yeah.
Yeah, but let's knock it down a peg, people. And so there was some outrage, but then, you know, I started really thinking about the category for actresses. And, you know, the complaint that I think is happening out there, really where the whole, you know, the women filmmaker not getting nominated thing is coming from.
Right.
It's, and then they give us a list of, look at all these, you know, women directors making these movies. And I think why the Little Women, there was such a passionate voice was, is that the reality is the particular crop of films this year that came from female directors, while maybe were good, there wasn't really a standout film. It has nothing to do with the fact that they were made by a woman.
Right.
It's just, I don't think they were good enough, except for maybe The Farewell could have been your best bet, except for maybe the direction wasn't the most star.
It wasn't, yeah.
Attraction of it. But that would be like, so far, that would have been like the one I would have to make the best case for. But so I think everybody was like hoping that Little Women was going to be this end of the year thing, that it would be as good as you hoped so that one female director could get in. And then it hit the festival circuit at the end of the fall. And the critics really weren't wowed with it.
Right.
But they almost felt they had to not bash it too much because it was Greta Gerwig following up from Lady Bird. And there's actually been some articles that came out about this that just talking about how like the critics really didn't warm up to it super, but they didn't want to be too harsh on it either. And that if they had maybe been, you know, a little bit more honest with their assessment of the film, it might not have had, you know, because people could have calmed down. But since they kind of kept it there. And then when it didn't get any year-end accolades from critics groups, then some people felt like they had to give it. Like the Boston Film Critics gave it like best film.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And it's not even, I mean, it's nowhere near in that conversation. And like I said, I liked Little Women for what it was.
Yeah.
If you had taken all of that away and say it was just dropped on you in the middle of the year, I would have been like, oh, it's a great movie, and I would never have even thought about it.
Right.
And I think it's only being thought about.
Now, who ran their Oscar campaign? Who produced this movie?
I have no idea. I mean, but obviously that was probably a big part of the package that was the year end. And this movie might have done even better had it been moved into like November, let's just say.
Okay. Oh, it's Columbia. Columbia put it Oh, no, wait, sorry, Columbia's the original Little Women.
Oh.
Not, I mean, the 94 right. Little Women.
Well, that wasn't the original either, but...
Right, no, that's why I corrected myself, yes.
But because of all this, I went and said, well, I haven't seen a lot of the Best Actress nominees, right? So how right. can I really judge, like, you know, like, I wouldn't have necessarily considered, you know, us as a Best Actress, you know,
right.
Lupita, but... The big front runner, who seems to be winning every award, every critic group is just kind of handing her this best performance, was Renee Zellweger for this Judy, which is...
Oh, yes, Judy.
I always find it weird when a movie is actually kind of critically panned.
Yeah.
But then the one person who's the star of the film is getting the accolades. And I'm like, well, how can you pan the movie and it's that bad, but yet praise the performance? To me, if the movie's that bad, then the performance can't be good enough to make it a good movie. And how right. can you be having that as award consideration? And there's been times when a movie like this, which was clearly Oscar bait, backfires horribly. I guess thinking of Nicole Kidman, she played Princess Grace of Monaco.
Oh, yes.
And that movie, they wouldn't release it. And then also Naomi Watts, she
right.
played Princess Diana in a movie. And I think that was so bad that it got, like, you know, maybe a straight to DVD release or something.
Wait, so this Nicole Kidman movie's never been released?
I think it's been released. You know, it's been
okay.
buried somewhere on, like, you know, the far reaches of Amazon Prime or something.
Right.
But
right.
I was never interested in watching it. But, you know, those kind of films, I think, are done for the exact same reason that Judy's done, is
right.
you have an actor or actress that wants a star vehicle and maybe get some accolades. So I knew that Judy was now available on Redbox. So I went and rented it.
Okay. Yeah. You were not only brave, but you jumped right into the fray there.
Well, I've been
you
sick.
Went out of your way. It didn't just like appear on your TV at home. You actually left the house.
Yeah. Well, I've been sick and I needed something to just kind of watch. So I was like, well, I can't say, you know, good or bad, but now after watching the film, I think that these people who are upset that Lupita Nyong'o didn't get a nomination for Us, they might have something there, because I'll take the Pepsi challenge with her performance in Us over this Renee Zellweger Judy movie, which was, it's honestly a Razzie award winning movie. It is a terrible film.
You watched the entire thing?
I did, though. I was hard to pay attention to it. I actually got sleep. I was sick. I got sleepy at one point, had to shut it off, come back to it. It is a disaster. It's like the worst Lifetime biopic. It does everything that you and I don't like about a biopic.
Yeah.
And it puts it, I guess it's based on a play, which also might be part of the
problem. Okay. Okay. Yeah.
The person who directed it, I can't think of his name offhand, but he is a theater person primarily.
Oh, interesting.
So clearly he doesn't understand anything about the language of film, and everything feels like it's on a soundstage, and it has very stodgy camera movements.
Weird.
And lighting. It just doesn't, it's like whatever. And sure, at sometimes Renee Zellweger kind of looks like Judy Garland in the later years. Obviously, Judy Garland was like a lot worse, because Judy, you know, Garland was like a heavy drinker, abused pills, and was like a chain smoker. And
right.
if you haven't been those all your life, and she was around the same age, actually, Renee Zellweger when she shot this movie, as Judy Garland was when she passed away. So they're close in age, but you can see that clearly. Renee's taking care of herself a lot better than Judy Garland did.
Couldn't they have done some little makeup job there?
Well, they did do some. It's just, I'm just saying that I never really, I felt like I was watching Renee Zellweger doing a Judy Garland impersonation.
Okay.
And one, I could say it was good, except that I, many years ago, saw the miniseries that Judy Davis was
Yes, I remember watching that. That was great.
Davis was amazing. I mean, she was about, I mean, so when you've already seen that, this is nothing. And this was a terrible movie. It had these awful devices where they would show back into her past, but they really focused on one little thing in her past to try to like make some connection to why she is the way she is now. And it was kind of like her being under Louis B. Mayer's kind of evil, creepy, handsy thumb.
Right. Okay.
And it's just, that didn't work. And from the opening shot was a flashback to her childhood getting ready for a screen test for like the Wizard of Oz.
Okay.
And she's walking sort of on the backstage with Louis B. Mayer and through these like sets. But the problem is that there's really no effort made to make the sets or anything look like even the Wizard of Oz really looked.
Oh, really?
From the sets. And it's just like, once you're into that lack of detail,
yeah,
you're in the hands of not a pro, but you're with the C team. And right. This whole film, it felt like the C team.
Right. Unless the film is going for some sort of stylized version of reality, sort of along the lines of, say, Rocket Man, or even that Kevin Spacey movie, Beyond the Sea.
Yes. I actually didn't mind that.
Yeah, no, it's a decent movie, but it just in terms of biopics, those sort of go a little bit away from reality a bit, but apparently that's not what's happening in this Judy movie.
Well, so here's the thing, and now you start to really wonder about this Academy, and it's funny because there was an article posted by this guy, Michael Musto, and he's like, he used to work for the Village Voice, and you know he knows all these Hollywood types, and he's always on the Oscar beat, and he finds Academy members,
yeah,
and he gets them anonymously talk about their picks.
Right, right.
And you get a little bit of an insight into these people and what they think. And, you know, you get this person's, they're kind of like just going to give it to her for whatever. But yet you could tell that the person didn't even think that the movie was any good.
Right.
And that their pick, and it sounds like based on the way it's going, is the 1917 with its, you know, flashy technical achievement over really any kind of emotional weight, that seems to be really what's appealing to these people. It won the PGA, which is the Producers Guild Awards, over the weekend. And so essentially, this is becoming the movie to beat. And I guess that's just what's going to win the Best Picture and probably Best Director. So the DGA Awards come out this weekend. If Mendes wins the Best Director, he's definitely, it's just, he will win Best Director at the Academy Awards. And then the film is probably going to win Best Picture. The only film right now that looks like it could upset is Parasite.
Right. And I can see somebody looking at their ballot and voting for Parasite for Foreign Language.
Ever since The Error, which has only been like, I don't know, like 10 years, maybe less,
yeah,
that they've been doing a preferential ballot.
Right.
You have to pick your number one pick and number two pick.
Yeah.
And instead of like to me, it's just like, couldn't you just call it a day? Whatever has the most votes should be the winner.
Right, right.
However,
they're doing ranked choice voting, right?
Yeah. So basically, your number one film has to get a certain percentage of number one votes. If it does, then they think, okay, most of the Academy thought this should get Best Picture, and it does. But if it doesn't, then it goes to what are the second place votes?
Right.
So what happens, and could happen, but we'll never know because they don't reveal the votes, is a movie that's second most popular kind of thing.
Right.
That's the one that
could easily.
It could be that, say, Once Upon a Time in America.
In Hollywood.
It had, let's say, a good chunk of, this is my favorite film. However.
Right.
It might be a very polarizing movie where it's either your favorite or it's one of your least favorites.
Right, right.
And it's not going to get to the second ballot. Whereas 1917, which is that, very mediocre, like, well, I can't really say anything bad about it. I mean, it was technically great. So, yeah, you know, I'm going to put my first choice as this. But, you know, if I had to go for a second one, it'll be that.
Right. Oh, man. Okay. I really want to see 1917.
I think you should. I mean, I didn't think it's a bad movie. I think it's good. And it does have some wow factor technical achievements. I just, you know, it wasn't enough for me.
Yeah. No, it didn't have enough story. It didn't have enough emotional engagement. I get it. Yeah. And I mean, that's why I want to see it so much, but my theater isn't playing it. But it seems like, you know, that the Academy always likes epics.
And it's not, well, it's not, it's funny. Well, it's about, I mean, World War I, I guess, is epic, but.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, and it has, you know, it has some epic scope shots.
Yep, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I only saw it once, but a film like The Irishman, and I think I first mentioned The Irishman to you right after I saw it in the theater.
Yes.
And I said that I wanted you to see it because I was having some struggles with it. Didn't mean I didn't like it. I just wasn't sure.
Right,
but see, the problem, the thing was, I kept thinking about it.
Yes.
Things were still in my brain and I had to process and I needed to see it a second time because I knew something was there.
Right.
Now, a movie like 1917.
It's all on the surface.
Well, I might see it again, but it never stayed in my mind that like, maybe I was wrong. I got to go back. That just didn't get that feeling. Some of the best films that I saw this year were movies that
like after I left the theater, day after, I couldn't stop thinking about it. Like once upon a time in Hollywood, when we reviewed it with the Willennial, I was in the process of, I saw that, you know, that opening night screening and I was expecting one thing and I didn't quite get what I thought. But I mean, I spent a week with it in my brain. It wouldn't leave me until I could see it a second time.
So I had a similar experience with another film that we're going to talk about today where it was not what I expected, but it has stuck with me.
Which one is that?
I guess we should just bring it up. The Lighthouse.
Okay. Table that for 1 second because we're going to jump it up. I'm going to finish up quickly with this.
Yeah,
thing.
No, so, let's finish up with this.
So Judy, well, basically after I saw that, not only should she not win the Academy Award, she shouldn't have been nominated. So that's when you start opening up the conversation. And I have to side with these people when they're saying, hey, you know, no person of color, you know, no diversity in the cast. To me, when you look at that performance of Renee Zellweger, nothing against her. I mean, she did the best she could. But then you think of what Lupita Nyong'o did, and I think people have a point and say, you know, she had to put a lot of layers into this. And, you know, talk about, you know, Renee Zellweger had to sort of impersonate a little bit like a Judy Garland accent. Well, Lupita Nyong'o had to, like, do an American accent.
She had to do an American accent. She had to play two different characters. She had to bring in this incredible physicality to the performance because one of those characters doesn't talk. And so I mean, the physicality of that performance is really interesting, how much she conveys through body language. And I think it's an interesting performance for that reason.
It was just today I read, they said, you know, not only did she give like a best actress performance, but she also gave a best supporting actress performance.
Right. Yes.
So, you know, I am thinking that one of the problems is that while in the best actor category, right? And even in the movies that, you know, are really like the large portion of what got nominated for Best Picture, you have all of these stories about men. You had these great, great, great roles for men this year. Yeah. And then women, there was Renee Zellweger in an okay imitation of Judy Garland. And then you had somebody imitating Megyn Kelly.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting because they're, like we said before, Sandler, I think, really should have been in there, but I guess there were too many great performances by men.
So another anonymous voter, this will tell you everything you need to know about the Academy, right? It's not everyone, but why Sandler didn't get in there, they didn't like his attitude. They heard him on Howard Stern, of course, joking that if he didn't get a nomination, he was going to make the worst. And they basically thought he was smug and entitled, and he hasn't kind of has the resume that deserves a nomination. And I'm like, are you what?
What?
Like, that's your criteria? You don't look and say this was a great performance?
Right.
I don't care who the person is. You don't like Adam Driver, but you recognize that he did a great job in Marriage Story.
Exactly, yeah.
You can't begrudge when the performance is good.
Well, yeah, I mean, exactly. The guy sort of rubs me the wrong way, but yeah, that was a great performance in Marriage Story.
You know, so anyways, this gamut of this week where basically after a couple days, all of the stuff about who didn't get nominated died down because then it turned into Guild Awards coming out and SAG Awards. And now people start to see the momentum is in two big movies, 1917, which is probably the expected, and then this Parasite, which... Right. A lot of people are now, you know, waking up to the fact that, wait a minute, I don't know what this movie is. It's a foreign film and it's getting this much praise. And it's a film that even my theater that won't show Jojo Rabbit on Friday is bringing Parasite to the area. And I'm hoping if I get a chance that this weekend, maybe I can go with my wife so she can see it because I just, it's a theater type experience.
It is. Well, and you know, it's so interesting because when I saw it, I mean, it had been hyped and everything, but I like this guy's other movies.
I have too, yes.
Yeah, and so I was, you know, prepared to like it the way I like his other movies. But sometimes I've liked his other movies and other people haven't liked them. Like, I know a lot of people who hate Snowpiercer.
Yeah, like that. For some reason that's very polarizing, but I like that. But yet I don't like Okja that much.
I like Okja, but I don't know if I loved it, but there was a lot going on in it that I liked.
The great directors, sometimes it takes them several movies, they start working on things, and then they find a movie that they put it all together.
Right, exactly. And anyhow, I like the guy, I like his movies, and so when I saw Parasite, I loved it, but I kind of thought, maybe it's just me, right? I mean, I knew other people really liked it too, but I thought, maybe it's just me and some critics that are sort of tuned into this. But it's not going to have popular appeal is basically
or the fact that some of the things that we talked about, that the ending might be a little off-putting to people, and that might spoil it for them, but it doesn't seem to be.
Well, and even the humor could be a little off-putting to certain people.
Right, would they find it funny?
I find the movie funny, but...
Yes, but it's clearly, it's resonating with anybody who actually sees the film?
Yes. Well, and that really, I did not expect it to have as wide an appeal as it seems to have. I guess that's what I'm saying, is that when I saw it, I thought, this is one of those things that's going to be loved by critics and a certain segment of the audience, and that's about it. But no, it's having a much broader appeal, and that surprised me, but I'm happy about it.
And if it surprises at the Oscars and it ends up winning Best Picture, not only would that make history, it being the first international film to ever win Best Picture, but I wouldn't go home unhappy. I mean, is it my number one movie of the year? Well, we'll have to wait and see.
Right.
But I certainly like it a lot more than 1917. So
I'm guessing right now that Parasite is in your top 10 somewhere.
Oh, I told you. I mean, that's the thing. We're holding out so you can see a couple more movies, and I'm hoping to see a couple, and then we'll reveal our top 10, because it's not, our top 10s are not contingent on what the Oscars do. So we'll have that in a couple of weeks. Now, you had said something to me offline in relation to all of this, and there's a bunch of great movies that A24 distributed this year, and they were like Uncut Gems, The Lighthouse, The Farewell, Midsommar, Last Black Man in San Francisco, High Life, Souvenir, In Fabric, Waves, Under the Silver Lake, Climax. I mean, they had a whole bunch of movies.
Yeah.
And in some ways, that resume is kind of like the Miramax of old.
It is, yeah. I mean, they are really doing something that Miramax did, which was basically giving their directors carte blanche. I mean, not totally, but they're allowing these movies to exist.
Well, they don't go and cut them up like what's his face Harvey used to do.
I also think there's less committee work going on at the beginning.
Yeah, they like great movies, and they're giving them, you know, when they can, they give them theatrical releases. Yeah. So, you know, you had said, well, what's going on with the marketing for A24? And I thought you're kind of insinuating like, well, why, you know, did the marketing fail these movies as far as getting some nominations?
That's part of it, I think.
So if you remember, a few years ago, they won Best Picture with Moonlight.
Yes. Yes.
They got Oscar for Room and nominations. Yep. And of course, they got nominations for Lady Bird.
Yes.
These were all A24 releases. And so you're wondering, well, what happened? Well, they are still a very small studio, and it cost a lot to mount an Oscar campaign. And I think it was suggested in an article that I read this past week that A24 has really weighed the value of all that money being spent on Oscar campaigns that aren't necessarily going to pay off.
Right.
And then instead of being able to, like, you know, distribute movies, and unfortunately, it's tough because some of their films, you know, like The Lighthouse got a nomination.
Right.
For cinematography. Very well deserved.
Very well deserved, yeah.
But Uncut Gems and Midsommar, I mean, okay.
And The Farewell. I mean,
and then The Farewell was their best shot for Best Picture. I think if it was a Miramax movie, it would be all over it, right?
Well, and they have these two great, they have Awkwafina in The Farewell and Sandler in Uncut Gems, and they're both great performances, and they both should have been nominated, I think.
Yeah, and this is the thing, is just because I think it's one of the better performances of the year, and I like aspects of it, I recognize that a movie like Midsommar is never going to get nominations.
Yeah.
So Florence Pugh, she got a nomination for Little Women. Again, having seen Renee Zellweger in Judy, how Florence Pugh wasn't nominated for Midsommar, where she had to do way more than Renee did.
Right.
And then even at the, okay, you don't like Midsommar, but like think of things like the costume design, the art direction, the cinematography, and the music.
Yeah.
So, you know, even things like that. But I think it's really just about the fact that, unfortunately, they want to be able to release more movies in a year rather than having to cut that, because Moonlight, Lady Bird, Room, by getting that Oscar nom, it kind of put them on the map.
Right, it did.
And I think they were fine with that, but now they have to kind of scale back.
So the other thing, not just in terms of their Oscar campaigns, but I sent you this message because I was watching The Lighthouse.
Now we're going to get into the story. So I saw The Lighthouse a couple months ago.
Yeah.
and in the theater.
Yeah.
And I know you weren't able to see it, but now that it's available for home viewing, you were able to check it out in your own little teal studio.
Exactly. And I kind of expected to like the movie, but I did not know what I was getting into. And I guess that's a good thing. I mean, I love going into movies blind. And so it was nice in that sense. But I also felt like the impression I had of what this movie was is not what the movie is. And I blame their marketing for that.
How do you market a movie like that? It's still black and white. It's still in that square format. So, I mean, and you don't want to give away too much.
Okay, but... here's what it is that my impression of the movie was that it was going to be, I mean, I knew the premise, right? It's two guys trapped in a lighthouse.
But did you see the previews? I mean, it looked like it was an off the rails movie, and it was.
I guess it was more off the rails than I expected.
That's what's so great about it.
Yeah, I'm not complaining.
Right.
I'm just saying that something about the marketing...
You're like, I didn't realize it was going to be that off the rails.
Exactly. And the marketing hadn't communicated that to me effectively.
Yeah, but does it have to, though?
No, it doesn't necessarily, but I think I would have been more excited to see it if I'd known how off the rails it was.
Well, I tried to get you to see it, but you said it wasn't available.
No, it wasn't.
Nearby your house.
There was no way I could have seen it.
And Will Lennial saw it, and he told you it was insane.
Well, I know, but for some reason, I guess what I didn't realize,
Are you saying that if you'd known just how insane this movie was, you would have driven the hour and 20 minutes to go see it in the theater?
Yes.
Ah.
That's what I'm saying. And I didn't know it was that insane. I was expecting it to be more realistic than it is.
Oh, yeah, no. It's very much like German expressionism.
Exactly. And I was expecting it to be more realistic and a little more grounded and more, I mean, there's plenty of dialogue in it, but it's not, you can't really say it's dialogue based.
Winslow.
But yeah, it was way more insane than I expected. And had I known that it was going to be that, here's what I wasn't expecting from it. I wasn't expecting it to be an experience.
Oh yeah. I mean, I just knew that when you eventually got to see it and you were, you know, by yourself in a darkened, your little darkened theater with your big screen projector and stuff, and you watched it, I just know you enough to be that you'd walk out going like, oh my God. And how can I spoil that for you? Because, you know, I told you, I still am mixed. It's not one of my favorite movies because I felt like there's still a little bit something missing for me, but that doesn't mean I didn't love it.
Well, here's the other thing is that little bit something missing, it's the same thing for me that you were talking about with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and The Irishman.
Right, where you have to see it a second time.
You kind of have to see it a second time because it does things that are so unexpected and weird that you're kind of caught off guard by it and feel a little bit unmoored. Some of the criticism of this movie is that it doesn't have enough story in the second half and that it sort of loses its narrative thread.
Well, that's when it starts to get more, like less realistic and a little bit more surrealistic.
And I get that, but when you're watching a movie and it doesn't fulfill that expectation, you feel a little bit unmoored. And you can walk away from it going, oh, there's something kind of missing there. It didn't quite nail the landing, right? But then, over the following few days, you know, I can't get this movie out of my head.
Danny! Let Neptune strike ye dead, Winslow!
Well, there's images. I mean, that guy, what a fantastic director this guy's turned out to be. Oh, my God. With David Eggers?
Yeah.
I mean, first The Witch, now The Lighthouse. You know, this is a guy that when the next movie comes out, I want to be there. I'm like, when is it coming out?
Me too.
I want to see what he's going to do next.
I will be at the theater. I will drive to the theater to, you know, I'll drive the hour and 20 minutes if that's what it takes. And I would have done this for that, if I had known just what a unique piece of filmmaking this is. And it's not like, yes, you can compare it to German Expressionism maybe, but there's very few movies you can compare this to.
What I like about a film like this is it gets to the sort of the truth that I'm always trying to distill about film and film experience. When you want to create something that's more than just like a story that's set in a time, you have to start thinking filmically. How do you want to convey that story. And what he does is he creates something that if you didn't know those two actors, you would think that this movie was pulled out of a vault from 1930.
Yeah.
One of the earliest sound movies. Because he went and shot it with those cameras, those lenses, on film.
Yeah, and the difference, I thought about this a lot, is that it does look like that with an exception, which is that those early sound movies didn't have a lot of camera movement because of the noise of moving the camera.
And the sound design of this movie is obviously, that's what I like. I don't mind when the sound design is 21st century.
Right, but okay, so my point is that at the end of the silent era, directors were really exploding in terms of what they could do with camera movement. And some big leaps in cinematic language happened towards the end of the silent era. When talkies came in, it ruined that because you couldn't move the camera anymore. In this movie, in The Lighthouse, he's doing a lot of what I would consider silent film techniques.
Yes.
But with sound. His camera movement is that of a silent film, I think.
Yes. And also, the aspect ratio he uses, not the Academy ratio 1:3. It's a weird sort of a little bit
it's
more
square. It's like 1:1:8 or something. Anyhow, yeah, it's some weird ratio. Basically a square. It's the silent movie aspect ratio. And this is, it has a lot in common with silent films, I think, in a really good way. There are sequences in this that are sort of just impressionistic, they're based on image. There's all this incredible sound design that goes along with it, but it's about experiencing this, at times almost montage of iconography. And it's about the experience of just sitting there and absorbing that and letting it kind of wash over you. The film does a pretty amazing job of that, I think. Yeah, so in terms of that thing that's missing, for me, it was in that last hour. Initially, I'm still undecided on the ending. I have some mixed feelings about the end. I'm not sure, particularly the last shot, I thought was inevitable and necessary, but not necessarily profound.
Yeah, I mean, I don't find anything in the movie necessarily profound. And like I said, that's where I think I'm falling in the same category you. I don't know whether you may have liked it more than I did. I look back on it with fondness just because it's such a great experience. Technically, it's funny, just like 1917, the technical aspects of it really shine. However, the difference also is that in addition to all this great technique, you have these two great, insane performances from Robert Pattinson and then Willem Dafoe, who also mysteriously was not nominated for an Academy Award.
I don't understand how. Yeah, I mean, both these guys.
On the one hand, you could look like him. He's chewing up the scenery, but there's a point where you get to that level of chewing up the scenery and then you take it beyond so that it's actually still a great performance.
Well, it's sort of like the first 45 minutes or so of this movie, the character he's playing has a character he plays, right?
Very, very well put. Thank you.
Yeah. And that sort of external role that he's built for himself, for both of them actually, have sort of built this sort of public role for themselves. And that starts to break down. And it breaks down to the extent that, like, their backstories come out. And you realize, wait, these guys are not who we thought they were at all. They've been sort of lying to each other and the audience. So when that starts to break down, what's kind of a cartoony performance from Dafoe at the beginning, the layers of that are stripped off until it's, well, really bare in a way that
hopefully now that it is available, people are going to be intrigued. But they got to need, like you always say, they got to know what they're getting into because it's not for everyone, right?
It is. This movie for a certain type of audience member is going to be incredibly disgusting and unpleasant.
Yeah.
I read one review that said, like, this is one of those few movies where you can smell it.
I get that.
Yeah.
It's funny, though, because, too, you've grown up where, you know, your family had a summer home on a little sort of remote little island.
Yes.
Off the coast of Maine. And, you know, you probably can relate to some of that feeling of cabin fever a little bit because you've gone up there during times when it's not populated.
Yes, I've been there during the winter and been sort of, I've actually been trapped in that house during the winter. in an incredibly cold winter. And there's something about the isolation. I mean, that's what this movie is essentially, is like a descent into insanity. It's it has the same narrative as Apocalypse Now, right? Which is that it starts in this one, it just slowly, it sort of incrementally gets more and more into this dark part inside these people. And so it's like a journey into darkness and into insanity. You know, God, there's so much to say about this movie. But one, there was a moment maybe about 45 minutes in where they first find out that they're not getting picked up again.
Well, that's when the movie makes a shift, right?
Yeah, the movie makes a big shift. And because early on, you're like, okay, whose point of view is this? Who do I trust? Who do I, you know, the Willem Dafoe character is kind of a jerk. So you're sort of following the Pattinson character more simply because...
If you had to pick a lead, he is the lead, in my opinion.
Yeah, because he's kind of the underdog, right? And so you kind of root for him a little bit more because he gets all the menial tasks assigned to him. And he's comes across as a little bit less of a mystery than the Dafoe character. Eventually, it turns out that he's just as mysterious. The scene between the two of them, and they're talking, and they're disagreeing over how long it's been since they weren't picked up.
How long have we been on this rock? 5 weeks? 2 days? Where are we? Help me to recollect.
Right.
Basically, the Pattinson character is saying it was yesterday, and the Dafoe character is saying it's been weeks, and we as the audience don't know who to believe. The film does not give us any handholds really outside of their perception. Like, we don't know if the stuff with the how real the stuff with the seagull is. There's this seagull that gives an incredible performance from the seagull.
You're giving too much away.
Okay.
But this is a movie where I guarantee you, like for instance, like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you got to figure that a lot of people are going to go see that or whatever. But a film like this, people should discover. Because it's not like, since it isn't that plot driven,
right.
I feel like any of the little surprises, I can just say, that, like you said, the way it gets insane creeps up on you. It's not like, oh, and then this, you know, I mean, you're like almost like waiting for it to get insane. And then before you know it, you're like, it's sort of like what you just said about that. It's been a day or a week. It's like, wait a minute. Was it normal 5 minutes ago and now it's insane? Or was it 20 minutes ago? I can't keep track.
Well, and that's my point, is that they're disagreeing, but we really don't know. And we become totally unmoored over the course of this film from any sense of what is real or a sense of time. And so instead of the movie just being a portrait of people going insane, which is what I was expecting, the movie itself goes insane right along with them.
Yeah, that's great craft, right?
It's great craft because it puts you right into, as the audience member, your thoughts become insane.
I saw a Parasite right before this.
Yes.
And then I did find my mind wandering at times in the film. And it's not that that's a bad thing. It's because the film almost makes your mind get very, you start going into out of things. And so it's very hypnotic, this movie.
And it's an experience. It's not a story or a plot. It's the meaning of the movie is to be found in sitting there and watching it. And what you go through mentally in response to at times is almost like a Rorschach test. Like, you know, like it's going to say a lot about the viewer, how they interpret this movie. But, you know, and like we said before, this, I can't recommend this movie to everyone because it's going to be really unpleasant for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm looking because I have my list of top 10 movies. I'm looking at my, you know what, on almost every one, I could recommend it in most of them to some people, but not others. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It sounds like, though, if we, you know, now that we've talked this through, I definitely feel like you really liked this movie. So
that said, while I was watching it, I actually had a lot of reservations. And at the end, I was like, maybe there's something missing, but it stuck with me. So I like the movie more now than I did right after I saw it.
And I think that's a good test, is that a lot of times, I think I'm a regular film viewer, I think they think, well, whatever I got while I'm watching the movie, that is, and so I think that's, again, we go to the superhero films. A lot of those people, they get a great experience and they come off a high and go, yeah, that was super great. And then that's the review.
Yeah.
They don't care that maybe 10 minutes later, half an hour later, you know, they don't want to think about the flaws. And I, of course, do. But at the reverse, some movies that are really great, while I'm watching it, and at the end, I'm not necessarily like, some of them I am, but not right. everyone. I'm like, this is great. But then it's about the reflection afterwards. Does the film grow on me and continue to grow and change my opinion a little bit? Because it has to be something if it keeps sticking in my brain.
Exactly. And to me, that just says it's worth watching a second time. You know, what we're talking about with these films that is they sort of defy our expectations the first time. And so we don't quite know what we're getting into. And so we're a little bit uncomfortable. So we don't maybe, you know, it's very easy to give yourself over to a Marvel movie like we were just talking about, right? You just like shut your brain off and like enjoy flashing lights for 2 hours.
Well, yeah, because the whole purpose of those movies is to give you kind of what you expect.
Exactly. And so if you get that, you walk out going, hey, I'm satisfied. I got what I ordered. But with a movie like The Lighthouse, you're going to go, I have no idea what I ordered. This is not what I ordered. What the hell is this thing? This is totally unrecognizable. I don't like it. I'm going to reject it because it's different than I was expecting. And then it's almost not until the second viewing when you can put those expectations aside and sort of see the movie for what it is and what the experience it wants to give you.
Well, I would say that a lot of people are going to be on the negative when it comes to The Lighthouse because they're going to say just like that, this is not what I was expecting, and they're going to reject it.
Yes. And, you know, I get that because I felt that way at times watching this movie, and I'm pretty open-minded when it comes to weird, experimental, impressionistic. Man, I also have to say, I'm asking you this because I don't know, there has to have been some CGI in this movie.
The Lighthouse?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe, but it's not. That's not the focus. So if it is, it's in the background and we're not even looking for it.
Well,
they shot it on a remote plate. I mean, they built the lighthouse.
I know they built the lighthouse. I could not believe that they got that good a performance out of a seagull.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who the seagull wrangler is or whatever, but you know, because we don't have super much time. Hey, look, sounds like a glowing recommendation for a really unique film from Teal and I, The Lighthouse. But here's more on the mainstream. A movie that I really enjoyed because I think that sometimes, you know, look, I'm not immune to Hollywood's charms.
And, absolutely.
And occasionally you get somebody who's been kind of doing the Hollywood thing for years and tries to put a stamp here and there. Like even with a superhero movie, he did that Wolverine Logan. Movie that everybody liked, Logan. And so it's James Mangold, who's a guy who in his early career, I really hated his movies. I feel like he's getting better.
Like Heavy?
One of the worst movies I ever saw. I hated that.
What about Copland?
And I hated Copland too. I hated that. Right. So at first I was like, when I saw Mangold come up, I was like, oh no. But over the time, he's really refined his craft and he's getting better. And I think that Ford versus Ferrari is one of his best movies. And again, it's completely following all the Hollywood rules. But unlike Judy, I felt it really worked for me. Plus, I know the story and I felt that it was very faithful to the actual story. So anyways, you didn't get to see it in the theater, but now you've seen it or you just recently got to see it.
I just recently got to see it. And yeah, you're right. I mean, it is about as slick a Hollywood movie as you could make, right? It's got that high gloss cinematography, the gliding camera movement, the traditional framing, and that's just, you know, on a filmmaking level. The screenplay also kind of hits all those Hollywood beats, and I guess you could say, the movie, you know, fulfills expectations, right? You're going into what's advertised as a car racing movie. You're going to get car races.
But yet when Ron Howard did Rush from a few years ago, that was based on a true story. I didn't find that very engaging.
And I didn't find it engaging at all. I don't think I even finished watching it, to tell you.
But yet this I found very engaging.
Yeah, and there's a couple of reasons for that. One is you got two great lead actors.
Christian Bale and Matt Damon.
And Christian Bale does a really, really great performance in this movie that is, I guess it's a little mannered, but not as far as he can go sometimes.
Well, it's also weird is because you think, well, he's doing this British guy, but he is British. He just never played, but you never see him play a British guy. So when he actually does like this kind of Cockney guy, you're not sure like if he's putting on a character or what, you know?
But it's a great performance. It's really engaging. And he's kind of the underdog of the story in a way. And so we really root for him and become involved involved in his character. He's also the only character who we get to see his home life.
Yes.
We never see Carroll Shelby outside of business, basically.
Right.
But we see this guy, Miles, with his kid and with his wife. But yeah, so the movie is totally slick. And I got to a point, maybe about an hour and 45 minutes in. The movie's 2.5 hours. And I was about an hour and 45 minutes in. And I thought, yeah, you know, I don't really want this to end. Like,
you know, there's an energy to the movie. Yes. And some of it is the way they use this piece of music.
The music is fantastic.
And it really gets you going. And, you know, again, it's a movie that you shouldn't like as much as you do. Like, it feels like, again, when Hollywood does it right, you get a movie like this.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it is. This is a Hollywood movie through and through. It is slick. Telegraphs itself really well. Like, there's no question about who the villain is.
So even though it's Ford versus Ferrari, Ford is kind of a villain.
Oh, it's Ford versus Ford, as far as I'm concerned. It's like these two guys versus corporate America, basically.
And that's why also, so it's like Mangold found ways to layer this thing, even though he's working within a Hollywood story.
Yes.
And then, because I know the story, and you might, things that...
I didn't know the story.
So things that don't seem like they could possibly be true are true. Like, it's Hollywoodized a little bit, but they literally went over to Ferrari to buy Ferrari.
Right.
And Ferrari used them and made sure that there were photos taken so that they could get Fiat. Was it Fiat buy them?
Yeah, it was Fiat, yeah.
And so things like that really happened. And then the way that race goes off at the end.
Yeah.
And the way that did, and the way they kind of screwed him over.
Right.
That happened.
I was involved enough in the movie and attached enough to the Christian Bale character that I was really angry at that injustice and how unfair that was. And I got really attached to his character, and I really felt for what he was put through. The fact of the matter is, it's a really enjoyable car racing movie with some good performances, super slick production, and some great music.
Well, I also think you don't have to like car, people think, I'm not that into car racing. I don't think you have to be.
No, you don't have to be at all. And in fact, that would be a nitpick for me. Is that I wanted more technical details about cars.
Oh, well, you're never going to get that in those movies anyway.
I know. But my point is that I was so into the story that I wanted to see more of that.
It made you interested in the subject.
Exactly. And I would love to watch a documentary about it, too.
Yeah, you can see it on Amazon.
Okay.
24 hours at Le Mans, I think it is.
Okay.
Or the 24-hour race, or whatever it is, it's a great documentary about this subject. And having seen that way before this movie.
Yeah.
I think it was called The 24-Hour War, maybe.
Okay.
That you'd think, the movie's just going to be kind of covering that same territory and it's not going to be that engaging. But I found it way super engaging, even though I knew some of the big plot points.
Well, there's a lot of energy, and, you know, it's a positive movie, right? Like, it's interesting to sort of be talking about this next to The Lighthouse, because I feel like they're both a little bit didn't quite get their due from last year.
Yeah, well, I mean, except for Ford versus Ferrari, clearly enough people liked it. It did get on the Oscars nominations for Best Picture.
Well, I know. Yeah, so enough people liked it.
And that's all it's getting. It's not going to win any of those.
It's not going to win any of those. But it's interesting. Yeah, I feel like they both didn't quite get their due necessarily. I mean, The Lighthouse definitely.
That's what we're here for.
Give
these movies their due. Well, that's where you are, trying to shine a light on films.
But I can recommend Ford versus Ferrari to a much larger group than I would recommend The Lighthouse to.
Yeah. And as far as pure pleasure, just cinematic entertainment,
yes.
I definitely was a Ford versus Ferrari fan over The Lighthouse. However, you know, a movie that I want to talk about the levels of detail is going to be The Lighthouse all day long.
Well, and I could watch The Lighthouse again today, but I wouldn't necessarily be ready to watch. I don't think I would get a lot more out of a second viewing.
Yeah, that doesn't mean I didn't like it. I know exactly what you're saying. I mean, when Ford versus Ferrari makes its way on HBO next year, I'll probably watch it again.
Like, I don't think it would be a hugely rewarding experience. It would just be, it's an entertainment. It's a great entertainment.
I need to see The Lighthouse a second time. I don't need to see Ford versus Ferrari a second time.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Yes, The Lighthouse needs to be watched, because now that I feel like I've been through The Lighthouse and I know what I'm getting into,
yes,
going back into it again, I won't have those resistances to it.
Well, that's how I felt with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah.
When I watched, even though I liked parts, when I watched it a second time after much reflection, it was just, it all worked for me.
Yeah.
And then ironically, the part that worked not as well for me was the last part of the movie, which was probably the most exciting on a visceral right. level the first time when you don't know what's going to happen. Once you know that's going to happen, that part isn't ever going to be as exciting.
Right.
But the
right.
rest of it, you can really appreciate.
Yeah. And that's a movie I do want to see again. But yeah, anyhow, Ford versus Ferrari, it should be checked out. It's worth watching. It's a good entertainment. It is 2.5 hours long. Oh, okay. Here's my other complaint about The Lighthouse while we're on this subject.
Okay.
I think it should have been a little bit shorter.
How long was it? I don't even know. Was it 5 minutes or was it 2 weeks?
I think it's about an hour and 45 minutes.
That movie's a 90-minute movie.
That's how I felt.
But then again, maybe you watch it again once you know what's coming. Because you know why? Because the journey, it tries your patience a bit.
Yeah, it does try your patience a little bit. I guess it's so intense that I feel like it could have been boiled down a little bit further, just a tiny bit. Because there's a couple of repeat beats.
Yep, I'm with you. I think a 90-minute movie, but at the same time, I'm not going to complain. Now,
I'm not really. I'm just being super nitpicky, and I may feel differently than it when I watch it a second time.
You like to be nitpicky.
I do.
All right. I want to mention a couple of things before we go.
Yeah.
So, and maybe once you've seen it, we'll talk about it. Our good friend, how good a friend she is, but she's a good friend.
She's a great friend of the show.
The great Kate Haight, editor who was on our program almost a year ago,
yeah.
She had mentioned this film called Troop Zero that she edited, and it has made its way onto Amazon Prime. It's an Amazon original,
right.
And they skipped theatrical release because I think they decided that that's really not where their bailiwick is. And
well, and unless they're going for Oscars.
Yeah, and when they recognize it, it doesn't mean that the movie's not good, but what they've been doing instead, though, is they've put a lot of effort in marketing this movie to get people to watch it. And independently, people who didn't even know or probably have ever listened to our show and who knew nothing about Kate have seen this film and actually like sent messages about it to me, like, oh, there's this movie Troop Zero, or I've actually even caught a conversation on Twitter from other random people and referencing Troop Zero. And so already in just one weekend, this Troop Zero movie, and probably because it's something that you can put on and it doesn't have to be like, oh, well, we have to wait till the kids are asleep. Like anybody can watch this movie. And it's a really fun, warm movie with some great performances. And I do recommend people checking it out. I mean, is it an Oscar? No. And it doesn't have to be an Oscar-worthy movie.
It looks to me like a fun family comedy.
It does. And it has a couple of little fun surprises in it that I think that, you know, we'll talk about after you've seen it. And, you know, actually even some funny editorial touches. So I definitely recommend that.
Yeah.
And then one other thing is that the end of the month is approaching. So Criterion's Sci-Fi 70s is going to go off.
Oh, right.
And we have made our way through another one that, Teal, in the next week, if you're looking for a 90-minute movie to watch, you got to see And God Told Me To.
Okay.
By Larry Cohen, the guy who did Alive.
Oh, yeah. Love Larry Cohen.
Have you ever heard of this movie?
No.
Well, you got to watch this thing because I'll give you the setup. And it's okay because you'll get the setup within the first 10 minutes. It's New York City, and the movie's like in the mid-70s. And there's this cop, Tony LoBianco. He was like a bit actor.
Yeah.
He is investigating. There's these crimes where people are like randomly killing people.
Uh-huh.
And he catches up to them, and they're like, well, why'd you do it? Like, there's a guy who's like mounted on the top of like a building high in New York City and starts shooting people randomly.
Right.
And then, of course, they kill the sniper. And before he's dead, he says, well, why'd you do this? God told me to.
Okay.
And every time he runs into a series of these people, they say, God told me to. And he's also a very religious man himself.
Oh, interesting.
And he's trying to unravel this mystery. All I will just tell you is that, think about this, it's in the collection of sci-fi 70s movies.
Right. I was about to say, where's the sci-fi
That's
angle?
What you got. I mean, this movie is crazy.
Did Larry Cohen write it? Do you know?
I don't know, but I got to tell you, it has some very interesting camera work and camera angles in this movie. And it's definitely a sort of step above your typical B movie. And I don't know why this movie has just been forgotten.
Interesting. Except by Larry Cohen fanatics.
I guess. That's what I love about Criterion. They offer me things that are, they're not necessarily like gold standard Criterion classics, you know,
from Ingmar
Bergman or something. But there's these movies that they're saying, take a look at these. You might have forgotten about them. And I mean, that movie, honestly, you will not, I know how you go looking for films sometimes to watch. Yeah. You're not going to be disappointed if you watch God Told Me To.
Okay, I will definitely be watching it before the next show.
Yeah, so watch that. And then, you know, I saw this other movie, David Lowery's Old Man and the Gun.
Oh, yes.
Robert Redford. You know, it was a breezy little movie. Kind of the ending kind of weakened out, but I saw that, you know, so there you go.
Okay, I like that David Lowery.
All right, well, hey, thank you for tuning into Stuff We've Seen. If you like what you heard and want to hear more episodes, go to our website at stuffweseen.com and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you download your podcast content. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at stuffweseenpodcast or on Twitter at stuff_VE. Hey, or drop us a line at feedback@jimandtail.com. Stay safe and go see some stuff.
Bye-bye.
Then I feel like we should have one of those things where we're talking to each other as the music plays on and we're going in there, you know, and then we laugh and go, oh, I remember that movie. And I'm like, oh, how about that scene with the seagull? Yeah.
Yeah, that seagull's got to be CGI.